Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of our radically democratic future.
I'm speaking with Mr. John Pike. He's the Director of Space Policy Project at the Federation of American Scientists. And Mr. Pike coordinates research, analysis, and advocacy on military and civilian space policy for them and other national security issues. He's the author of over 200 studies and articles on space and national security, and the co-author of the book, The Impact of the U.S. and Soviet Ballistic Missile Defense Programs on the ABM Treaty. Welcome, Mr. Pike.
Glad to be here.
Could you describe for us a little bit about the Federation of American Scientists, its origin and its composition?
Well, the Federation of American Scientists was founded in the fall of 1945 as the Federation of the Atomic Scientists by a number of scientists who had worked on the original Manhattan Project that built the first atomic bomb. They were concerned that the atomic bomb was a new technological innovation that military planners and politicians and the public were unprepared to deal with, and consequently, there was a need for public and political education around this technological innovation. And for the last half century, we've basically continued in that tradition, attempting to address questions of science, technology, and public policy, particularly, but not exclusively, in the national security field.
And what are some of the ways that the FAS intervenes in public policy?
Well, I'm doing one of them right now. We spend a lot of time talking to the public through print and broadcast media. We have one of the largest nonprofit organization websites on the Internet. We're called on to testify before the Congress, and we work with a number of other organizations on topics of interest to our membership.
You work on quite a diverse set of topics. So you have programs for monitoring emerging diseases. You work on government secrecy, intelligence gathering, computer policy, military policy, space policy, drug policy. How do these different projects get initiated? Is it a democratic process within your organization?
Well, there are a number of different ways that we can decide to work in a field. One of the key questions that we have to ask is whether this is a policy area that it looks like there's going to be potential for actually changing policy, whether it's one that has a significant technical or scientific component that we can contribute to, and one whether we can find the resources to pay somebody to actually work on it. It's a complicated process, and there's no simple answer to it, but those are the factors that we have to take into account.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're the director of space policy issues, and I understand that your work grew out of the work against the Reagan-era Strategic Defense Initiative, SDI, more popularly known as Star Wars. Is it fair to say that Star Wars is now seen as failed, dead, and irrelevant?
I think that that's the popular view of what happened to Star Wars. Actually, it's alive and well, probably closer to being deployed today than it ever was during the Reagan era. And we continued to spend about $4 billion a year on Star Wars, about the same amount that we did when Ronald Reagan was president. With the Republican majority in the Congress and with the Clinton administration not wanting to antagonize the Congress on national security issues, the Senate a few days ago came within two votes of deciding to deploy Star Wars, and the current betting is that they're going to pick up those two votes in the election this November. So the reports of the death of Star Wars have been greatly exaggerated.
Now, the what's the substance of the critique of Star Wars that you and others have given?
Well, it's basically the lessons that should have been learned out of the failure of Patriot during Operation Desert Storm. As soon as President Reagan announced Star Wars, we said there were going to be some fundamental problems with getting the thing to work. Computers were not going to be completely reliable, as anybody who's operated a desktop computer knows, and the radars were going to have a hard time figuring out which targets the interceptors ought to be shooting at. Well, lo and behold, Patriot and Desert Storm had precisely those problems. It looked good on TV, but subsequently, after the conflict ended, the Israeli military, the U.S. Army, analyzed Patriot performance, concluded that it had failed almost completely over Israel, and it missed more often than it had hit over Saudi Arabia, for precisely the reasons that we feared. The computers weren't reliable, and the radars couldn't figure out which of the many objects in the sky were the real targets they ought to be shooting at. We've spent, 20, $25 billion since Desert Storm on trying to perfect these systems. Every test that has been conducted since then has failed. We're no closer to having a successful system today than 15 years ago when President Reagan initially announced the program. Nonetheless, the politicians continue to like it, they continue to throw money at it, and I'm afraid that we're going to deploy it.
So it's a waste of time, and it also gives us a false sense of security, doesn't it?
Well, I'm afraid that it might, in the sense that if you believe the brochureware, if you believe the claims of its advocates, we could basically contemplate fighting a nuclear war with North Korea or fighting a nuclear war with China under the assumption that if one of those countries launched nuclear-tipped missiles at us, we wouldn't have anything to worry about because Star Wars would intercept it. Obviously, that isn't the case, and I would hope that the president and the military leadership would know better if we actually got into a conflict.
Now, are there other ways in which space is being militarized?
Well, space was militarized from the very beginning. Both the United States, Russia, and more recently other countries have been using space for the same sorts of things that everyone else does, weather satellites, communication satellites, navigation satellites, and obviously for military applications such as imagery intelligence and signals intelligence. What has not happened thus far is the emplacement of weapons in space, but even there the Clinton administration has continued the space laser programs initiated under the Reagan administration, and we're not too many years away from actually putting laser weapons in space.
You also work with the United Nations offices on outer space and the emerging body of international law that governs space exploration. Do you think that these are effective tools for the peaceful, the pacification of space?
Well, they're clearly not as effective as many countries think that they need to be. There's currently a move afoot in the Committee on Disarmament in Geneva to negotiate a new space weapons convention which would ban the sort of space lasers that were the hallmark of Reagan and Clinton era Star Wars programs. There's broad international support for making space a weapons-free zone. Some of the defense contractors here in the United States have a different idea. Fortunately, we still have a few years to decide who's going to prevail on that subject.
So has the U.S. ratified the International Treaty on Space?
Well, there have been a number of treaties that have been in place governing activities in space for quite some time. The 1967 Outer Space Treaty was the charter document. It prevented putting nuclear weapons in space. We signed it. Everyone's complied with it. What there is currently negotiation on, however, is a new treaty that would prohibit putting any type of weapon in space, including non-nuclear weapons. It's just only in the last couple of months that the United Nations has started work on this, and based on how slowly some of these other treaties were developed, I think it's going to be several years before we know the final outcome.
Mm-hmm. But there are agreements about the commercialization and ownership of, say, the planets and property on planets.
Well, that's another area that international law is unsettled. About 15 years ago, a convention was negotiated concerning property rights on the moon or elsewhere in outer space. Only about a dozen and a half countries, not including the United States, ratified that convention. And I would say presently that area is one of considerable ambiguity under international law. Given the small number of countries that ratified the Moon Treaty, that probably does not represent a well-established international legal regime.
It may be a moot point, at least from U.S. perspective, because it appears that there's eroding public support for further pushes to the moon and to Mars. Do you think, is it the position or your position that human beings have a compelling interest in space?
Well, I certainly have had a compelling interest in space ever since I've been a small child. The United States government, particularly successive presidents, have seen human spaceflight as being an important instrument of our national security and foreign policy. Over the last 5 years or so, the Clinton administration is seen cooperating with the Russians and other countries in piloted spaceflight as being a way of demonstrating U.S. national leadership. And I think very importantly, as a way of keeping Russian rocket scientists in Russia and out of other countries such as North Korea, where they might be working on missile programs that would threaten us. I think the problem that the Bush administration had in its ideas for returning humans to the moon or sending them to Mars was that they simply couldn't explain what larger national objectives would be achieved by such expensive missions.
Currently, on that theme, NASA's trying to bail out the Russian space program to maintain its cooperation in building the $40 billion International Space Station. What advantage do we have to gain from investing in Russian space technology?
Well, I think that we have several advantages from working with the Russians in piloted spaceflight, such as the International Space Station. One of them is it demonstrates very clearly and visibly that the Cold War is over and that America and Russia are partners, not adversaries. It's difficult to imagine any other way that we could so visibly demonstrate the changed nature of our relationship. It's also a very important instrument for allowing the Russians to retain some sense of standing in the world, giving them that sense of pride that they don't have to recoup some other way through military adventures. Most importantly, I think that it's a way of keeping the talents and energies of Russian rocket scientists and engineers engaged in Russia, working on peaceful cooperation rather than moving to North Korea or Iran, where they'd be working on missile programs that would threaten their neighbors. This non-proliferation policy has been extremely effective over the last 5 years. It's helped shut down missile programs in North Korea, made it more difficult for Iran to build missiles, and for the few hundred million dollars a year it's cost us, it's been a bargain compared to the $4 billion a year we've been spending on Star Wars.
Recently, Robert Zubrin and several hundred other Mars enthusiasts have formed the Mars Society. What's your perspective on the prospects for Mars colonization and terraforming?
Well, I certainly hope that I live long enough to see humans get to Mars to get to the bottom of the question of whether there was or is life on Mars. That's the most likely other site for life here in the solar system. And finding out whether there was life on Mars would be very important for understanding whether there's other life, including intelligent life, elsewhere in the universe. Unfortunately, going to Mars would be very expensive. Bob Zubrin and his associates have some ideas for how to make it less expensive. But at the end of the day, I think that until we come up with a compelling foreign policy rationale, such as going to Mars with the Chinese or the Indians, we're going to have a hard time persuading the politicians and the taxpayers to pay for it.
So you see space exploration for the foreseeable future being pretty much the terrain of governments and intergovernmental cooperation. What about market forces? Do you think that private commercial space exploration is feasible?
Well, of the three major sectors of the American space program, the civil sector, such as NASA, the national security area, and the commercial sector, today the commercial sector is the largest of the three, and it's also the fastest growing at about 10% a year, whereas the civil and national security sector budgets are flat. There are a lot of very exciting things commercial space can do. There are a lot of things that they simply can't make money doing, such as sending people to Mars. And I think that we have to have a very clear understanding of the appropriate roles of the commercial and civil sectors in our national space program. Commercializing human exploration of space may happen at some point in the third millennium. I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon.
Recently, NASA turned over a lot of programmatic flexibility to contractors who are building satellites, and they kind of blew up in their face with the Lewis and Clark satellites. Do you think that the failure of this turn toward the market on the part of NASA is emblematic of the need to have greater governmental control in this area?
Well, aerospace contractors have always constituted the overwhelming bulk of the people who are working on the space program. Even back during the Apollo era, about 10% of the people working on Apollo worked directly for NASA. The other 90% were contractors. It's unavoidably the case that space is a risky business, and unavoidably there are going to be program failures. Having said all that, I think that over the last 5 years or so, NASA may have moved a little too far in the direction of giving responsibility and authority to the aerospace contractors. And consequently, NASA has not been in a position to make sure that the taxpayers are getting the full value for their dollar. The contractors unavoidably remain the center of competence and expertise, but we have to be sure that when the taxpayers are paying something, they're getting their money's worth, and clearly there have been some instances lately where they haven't.
it seems like entrepreneuring, the idea of giving small teams limited resources but a great deal of flexibility, worked well with the Mars Explorer project.
Well, I think that the bottom line is that sometimes you have good luck and sometimes you have bad luck, and unfortunately in advance there's no way of knowing for sure exactly what sort of managerial model is going to work out. At the same time, when you have bad luck, at least you need to try to learn some lessons from that, and I think that in the case of a couple of the failures that NASA's had with these new management models, they need to understand that NASA needs to have greater involvement in the process than simply giving the contractors the money and hoping for the best.
To turn away from space for a second, to your newly initiated Millennium Monitor project, I understand it's not yet a fully funded one of your projects and that you're looking for greater public involvement and support. But I think it has a fascinating impetus, which is that your concern, or the concern of FAS, is that millenarian groups and individuals may see the coming of the millennium as an excuse to use weapons of mass destruction, and especially groups like Aum Shinrikyo in Japan. And your purview, and you, by the way, are also the webmaster of the wonderful Federation of American Scientists website, and the Millennium Monitor part of that is what originally attracted me to this topic, because you have hundreds of different millennial groups being monitored and tracked there through their own web presence, including things like Y2K, the year 2000 bug. Can you speak a bit about how the purview of your project has expanded?
Well, one of the interesting things about the year 2000 is that one can say with considerable confidence that it's going to be a period of considerable instability and turbulence, if for no other reason because it is entirely foreseeable that due to the millennium bug, the year 2000 problem with computers and embedded chips, that there's going to be a significant amount of disruption in major American institutions due to computer failures. It's hard to say exactly where those failures will take place, hard to say exactly how extensive they're going to be, but just as surely as Old Faithful Geyser erupts or Halley's Comet comes back, you know in advance that the year 2000 is going to be a period of turbulence and disruption simply due to these computer failures. At the same time, there are going to be other network disturbances due to Cycle 23, which is the effects of the 11-year solar cycle, solar storms producing disruptions in communications and electric power grids here on Earth. All of this happening at a time of very intense millennial and apocalyptic interest in our culture and society. And we've already seen apocalyptically oriented groups such as Aum Shinrikyo and other fringe militia groups motivated by apocalyptic ideologies engaging in patterns of mass violence. And I think that there's every reason to believe that we're going to be seeing more instances of that in the next 18 to 24 months.
Mm-hmm. So the combination of people's expectations and some actual things that you expect to go down around the year 2000 might be a bad combination.
Well, I think that the bottom line is that when the going gets weird, the weird get going, and the going is going to start getting weird over the next 18 months.
Yeah. Well, again, I want to recommend that people visit the FAS website. It's www.fas.org, and you can check out the work of Mr. John Pike there, and also the Millennium Monitor site is a part of that. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS-FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about radical democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. Also, check out past and future shows and myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com.